This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of June 2017. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Apparent inconsistencies in the Travis County Sheriff's policy of limited cooperation with federal immigration authorities.
This can be left up to a singular person who can make a decision one day and then make a different decision another day when we're looking at the same person and the same crime.
The story behind those handmade "We Buy Houses" signs around Austin.
Usually we mostly work with distressed sellers, people that are having trouble. Maybe they fell behind on their payments.
And a food trailer on East Cesar Chavez serving street food from northern Thailand.
It's a small menu, but pretty much everything on it is great.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, just a reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. If you go there, you'll find links to our iTunes feed, our Stitcher feed, SoundCloud, or RSS. And if you have a minute, leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app or in the iTunes store. It helps other people find this podcast. If you have any questions, email me, Nathan at KUT.org, or you can ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. So this week, the Texas legislative session came to an end on Monday. It was Signy Die, and here to talk about it is KUT senior editor Ben Philpott. Hello, Ben.
Signy Die, how you doing?
What does Signy Die mean?
I'm so glad you asked. Signy Die is Latin for without a day, essentially. So whenever you adjourn a meeting, you say in the House or the Senate, the House adjourns until 10 a.m. Tuesday morning. But you don't do that on Signy Die. You adjourn Signy Die, meaning you adjourn without a day to come back.
What are the big legislative achievements by this Republican-dominated Texas legislature this time around?
Well, I think they would say that one of them is, as always, providing a balanced budget for the state. Now, constitutionally, they have to provide a balanced budget, so there's no wiggle room there. But you know, they got one done. This was a tougher budget year. There were some cuts made that plenty of people will complain about and have already started complaining about. But I think the leadership, you know, if we're going to frame it through them, passing that budget was number one. I would guess that number two is probably Child Protective Services reform. You know, the state has been in court, recently had a pretty scathing ruling against them for a lack of just doing a good job with children, which is never a good thing to be told, especially by a court. And so they've sunk some more money into CPS. They've started a little bit of a privatization in terms of more community groups helping out with where kids are placed when they are taken away from their parents. They're hoping to dramatically increase the number of beds that they have. You may remember, Nathan, that they've had stories for the last few years. I think Dallas Morning News did some really good reporting about this, of kids, you know, sleeping on the floor of the CPS offices.
Yeah, I talked to CPS about that last week, and they reported that they had seen some of the highest levels yet of children sleeping in state offices. I think it was like 60 in March and 70 in April or something like that. So it's obviously a problem.
Yeah. So part of this kind of privatization, they're hoping that that's going to, you know, get rid of that problem.
Now, on the controversial legislation side, of course, we had Senate Bill 4, which we've talked about a lot on this podcast. Sanctuary cities bill, so-called sanctuary cities bill. There's no universal definition of what a sanctuary city
that's
is.
That's right.
But the supporters call it a sanctuary cities bill, which, as we've said before, will require the Travis County Sheriff to honor all warrantless requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement to keep people in jail, even if they've been cleared for release, keep them in jail if they are suspected undocumented immigrants that ICE has requested them to keep. And also, police will be allowed to ask anyone their immigration status if they've been detained. But what about the most controversial legislation that was not approved?
I would guess people would point to the so-called bathroom bill. We like to say so-called, right?
Because it's just so easy when you have limited time on air.
You know, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, they spin even with the titles of their own bills. So this bill...
I will say, though, I haven't been using so-called for the bathroom bill because it is a bathroom bill.
Right.
It we know what bathrooms are.
Well, so maybe we should say that Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who championed this bill in the Senate, he calls it the so-called Women's Privacy Act.
Right, yes.
So, yes, this would be a bill that would bar schools and state buildings from allowing a transgender person to use the bathroom that corresponds with their gender identity. Also, it would override any current municipal ordinances that allow for non-discrimination of transgender people, and would then bar any other municipalities from creating their own ordinance, non-discrimination ordinance. So it did get a lot of play in the Senate, passed the Senate, and then spent, the lieutenant governor spent a long time screaming at the House about how they needed to pass it.
And I want to ask you about this, kind of led to a showdown in the state legislature between the House and the Senate. And I just want you to set it up for us quickly, because it explains what Governor Greg Abbott, the position that he's in right now.
So essentially, the showdown was absolutely about the bathroom bill and a bill that would have made it harder for municipalities to raise property taxes.
Without an election.
So that's what the arguments back and forth were. The technicality that kept those from passing, or really ginned up the arguments, was that the Texas House and the Texas Senate did not get a bill through that would keep several state agencies open and operating. They needed to pass this bill so that they could wait until 2019 to kind of review those agencies and then see if they needed to make changes and just keep them open. Without the bill, they shut down before the legislature comes back again in 2019. So that was the behind the scenes battle. You had to have this bill passed, but the lieutenant governor was using it as, if you don't pass a bathroom bill, if you don't pass this property tax bill, then this scheduling bill, as it's called, will not pass and will have to come back for a special session. Essentially, Speaker Strauss in the Texas House said, "We are done negotiating on the bathroom bill." And that's it. And then, of course, the property tax bill, the House passed a version, sent it over to the Senate. The Senate didn't want to negotiate on that one either. So now we're just in a waiting game here to see what happens, see whether or not we do get a special session called.
It's Friday afternoon right now. Right. Governor Abbott said he was going to let us know by the end of the week whether he intended to call a special session. But this morning he said, actually, no.
Maybe not, later.
Yeah, next week maybe. But is he in a position now where he has to choose between Joe Strauss's vision of Republican conservatism in Texas, the more, I guess you might say, moderate or business
Chamber of Commerce. Yeah.
And then the more socially conservative Republican conservatism in Texas of Dan Patrick. Does this put Abbott in a situation where he has to choose between the two, or is that kind of overstating it?
I don't know that that is overstating it. I think that what he's probably trying to do right now is figure out if he can do it without choosing one of them. So if he calls a special session and only deals with those agencies that are going to be shut down, because, the governor, of course, is the only person that can set the agenda for a special session. So if he calls one and says, we're just going to deal with these agencies that are closing down, then essentially he has picked Joe Strauss. If he calls the session and says, yes, the agencies, but also bathroom bill and maybe property taxes, then he has sided with the lieutenant governor. I think what he might be trying to do is sitting there and figuring out if there's some kind of executive type action that he can do through maybe the Legislative Budget Board or even through the Sunset Commission, which deals with these agencies that might shut down, and delay or dramatically slow the wind down of the agencies as they hit their points where they're supposed to close. I think that if he could figure that out, that would be the third option that he would rather take than choosing the sides.
KUT senior editor Ben Philpott, he'll be watching next week closely.
It'll be a
special session.
It'll be a special week.
It'll be a very, very special week. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Travis County Sheriff Sally Hernandez was elected on a promise to end cooperation with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement at the Travis County Jail. I was looking through her Facebook feed, and in September, she wrote during the campaign that anyone arrested will go through the same process of booking, magistrate, and prosecution. And when she wrote that on Facebook, then Sheriff Greg Hamilton had a policy of honoring all warrantless requests from federal immigration authorities to detain suspected undocumented immigrants who had otherwise been cleared for release. Once Hernandez was elected and assumed office, she made some exceptions to her promise. Sheriff Hernandez said she would honor ICE requests if the person had been accused of one of three crimes: aggravated sexual assault, human trafficking, or murder. Then some informal modifications were made to the policy. Hernandez's office said she may honor ICE requests in some cases in which the elderly or children were victimized. Now, a new analysis by KUT News finds apparent inconsistencies in the ICE detainer policy. A policy, I should add, that gave fuel to the state legislature to pass a law that requires local officials to honor all ICE detainer requests or face criminal charges and removal from office. That law is scheduled to take effect in September if courts don't block it. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has been analyzing data she obtained through an open records request. And Audrey, lately, when I walk by your cubicle, I see lots of spreadsheets open.
Yes.
So it's a lot of clicking through Excel?
Yeah, it was a lot of... I'm also working on another public information request that requires a lot of data. So it's been kind of an Excel spreadsheet week, which is fun.
What were the inconsistencies you found?
Sure. Well, there were two pretty blatant inconsistencies, and I should say two cases in particular. So I was analyzing data from March 1st to May 5th. So over a two-month period. And during that two-month period, the inconsistencies I found actually related mostly to re-offenders, people who were booked twice over that period of time into Travis County. So the first one was a 38-year-old man. He was originally booked on a charge of DUI third or more, meaning he'd had previous DUIs. An ICE detainer was issued for him, and the Travis County Sheriff's Department honored that ICE detainer. He was released to ICE, according to the Travis County Sheriff's Office. But then about 2 months later, he was rebooked on the same exact charge, on the DUI third or more. ICE is still looking into why he was released from their custody. But in that second time that he was booked, the ICE detainer was declined. And so I asked Travis County, I asked Kristen Dark, the spokesperson, why this was inconsistent, why the application of this ICE detainer on the same man, same exact charge, why it was applied differently. There wasn't a clear answer. You know, I was told, you know, it's up to the captain at the time. There must have been something different in that first charge. Mind you, it's the same bail amount. So a judge had decided it's the same severity. It's the same exact charge on paper. So there's really no understanding why it was declined that second time.
So that was the first inconsistent case you found. What was the second?
Yes. So the second one was an 18-year-old man, and he was originally booked into Travis County on the charge of organized criminal activity. And I got a little more detail about that because it sounds kind of mafia-esque. And actually, that crime applies when you're basically doing criminal activity with two or more people.
Okay.
So he apparently was pulling on door handles of cars, presumably looking to take stuff from cars.
So he's not necessarily like... in the mafia or a Mexican drug cartel or anything.
No. So it can sound much more serious than it is. So with that first charge, the ICE detainer came in and it was denied. It was declined by Travis County Sheriff's Office. He was released on a personal recognizance bond. That's a no-cost bond. And I think it was about a month later, he was rebooked on a charge of home burglary. So this time he broke into a home, burglarized the home. And in that second case, the ICE detainer on him was actually honored and he was released to ICE. So I asked, you know, home burglary does not fit, you know, those three high level felonies the sheriff said she would honor ICE detainers for. Why in this case? I mean, we're talking about an 18-year-old person. And I was told while the spokesperson didn't have access to the captain's notes at the time, because apparently they do take notes. I've tried to get this. I've been blocked. She believes that it was because it was an escalation of criminal activity. You know, he's jumped up a notch. Now he's entered someone's home rather than someone's car. But still really interesting because, you know, the sheriff has said she still maintains the right to apply this on a case-by-case basis, but it seems like it's pretty subjective or applied subjectively, yeah.
Are we only talking about two cases out of how many?
So two cases of about 160 in this two-month period. So yeah, you're right. It's rare. These inconsistencies are rare. But I think they speak to the fact that this can be left up to a singular person who is not the sheriff, who can make a decision one day and then make a different decision another day when we're looking at the same person in the same crime. So, you know, you're opening yourself to a lot of questions, I would say.
Those might be a type of inconsistency, but there are also cases where people were handed over to ICE who were accused of committing crimes that didn't fit within those described by the sheriff's policy. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So eight of these, about 160 cases in that two-month period, were eight cases where inmates had an ICE detainer placed on them, and then they were released to ICE. And of these charges, they were booked on, we see DUI, we see manufacture and delivery of a drug, we see sex abuse of a child, which does fit in with the specific crimes the sheriff has set. And we also see assault, and we see aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Now, a few of these, DUI specifically and the drug charge, are considered nonviolent charges, yet people were turned over to ICE. So I asked the sheriff's office about this. You know, these people are not murdering folks. You know, this is not aggravated sexual assault. This is not human trafficking. And I was told most likely, though it could not be confirmed on these specific cases, that criminal history played a factor. If you go and look at the sheriff's policy, she does say those three high felonies she set out, if someone's booked on those charges or has been convicted of those charges in the past, she will honor the ICE detainer request. And I think that's been overlooked in the coverage, is the play that criminal history has in this. But again, I will repeat, I was not able to get access to these people's criminal history. I was not able to get confirmation on these specific cases that the criminal history played a part. So it's one factor that may have played a part in why these people were released to ICE.
Nevertheless, we've come a long way from candidate Sally Hernandez's campaign promise. I'll go back to this Facebook post from September where she wrote that, quote, anyone arrested will go through the same process of booking, magistrate, and prosecution, end quote. Whether you agree with that policy or not, it helped her get elected. She got a lot of support from immigrant advocates. What are they saying about what you've uncovered here?
Yeah, I spoke with Bob Leibel from Grassroots Leadership. So I laid out for him, you know, the analysis I did, the specific cases I've talked about so far. And he kind of was, you know, like, that's all interesting, but actually I've had an issue with her policy from the beginning. And I asked him, what do you mean? And he said she campaigned on a promise to not honor any ICE detainers. So the fact that she has agreed to do so for specific high-level felonies and on a case-by-case basis, he had a lot of trouble with that. And the point he made to me was that immigrants, undocumented or otherwise, he felt like there was an assumption of more criminality, there needing to be an extra level of detainment placed on someone who has been booked and will be subject to the criminal process we have here in the U.S. So that was really interesting. I heard that from Ashley Fisher as well with Raices, who has offices in San Antonio, D.C., and Austin. She took a perhaps harsher stance than Bob. And, you know, she said the sheriff was elected on this promise to not honor any ICE detainers. And we're not seeing that, and we're upset about it. So whereas, you know, we've seen a lot of support from the immigrants' rights community, especially in the face of SB4 and a lot of support for the sheriff, there are some mixed emotions about this policy.
KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reporting on some inconsistencies that she's uncovered in the ICE detainer policy maintained by the Travis County Sheriff's Office. You can read her story at KUT.org. Thanks for talking to me, Audrey.
Thanks so much.
The U.S. Census Bureau has new numbers on the population of U.S. cities, and they show Texas led the nation in growth for large cities. But buried in that data was another story. It's KUT's Mose Bushell reports. It's a story about the deeply linked fates of some cities and the oil industry.
When I asked Texas state demographer Lloyd Potter if there was anything surprising in the new numbers, he said maybe Houston in Harris County.
So in the past 3 or 4 years prior to the 15-16 set of estimates, Harris County was the most significant growing county in the country, numerically.
People were moving there from other parts of the U.S., and immigrants were moving there from other countries. But that's changed. Now U.S. residents have started to leave the city.
That was offset by immigration, so it had net positive migration, but that was because people were moving here from other countries.
Potter thinks it has to do with the oil industry. He says a lot of U.S. citizens who had moved to Houston moved there to work in oil or related fields. When the price of oil went bust in 2014, they were the ones who left. Houston isn't the only place.
In areas that are gas and oil related, and no one here wants to hear this, I think we're seeing some slowdown.
Steve Murdoch is the former director of the U.S. Census Bureau and current director of Rice University's Hobby Center for the Study of Texas.
You go to Midland, Odessa, which is pretty much a a town very much centered on a couple, you know, gas and oil industries, you're seeing a substantial slowdown.
Of course, oil prices have started to rebound, so in the next round of census numbers, you'd expect to see population rebound along with jobs, but maybe not as much as you'd think.
The reality is that that hasn't really happened to the degree we would have expected.
Michael McDonald is a professor of finance at Fairfield University. He also consults for energy companies. He points out that one reason the industry's bounced back is because it cut costs. That means, like a lot of other industries, it's having computers and machines do the work people used to do. So even if the industry's back, the jobs might not be.
And so we've seen that in particular, both in kind of high-end jobs, like, say, the petroleum engineering space, and we've seen that in sort of the more classic blue-collar workers on the rigs and things like that.
He says the full impact of automation on jobs and population will become clearer as the oil industry continues to recover from the last big bust. Moz Bushel, KET News.
You've probably seen them while driving around town, those handwritten signs along the street that say stuff like, "We buy houses for cash, call now." One person who listened to KUT wondered what the story was behind those homemade signs. Who's looking to buy up these houses and what actually happens if you call the number? Well, for the latest installment of our AT Explained series, KUT's Saida Hassan looked into it.
Our question asker, Jennifer Kolb, is a graduate student studying social work at UT. But before that, she used to work for an affordable housing nonprofit.
Yeah, every day on my way to work, I would pass this, you know, hand-lettered, white with black marker sign that just says, "We buy houses for cash, fast." And I was just like, what is that about? That's weird.
She also wondered why this method of advertising.
It was interesting to me because why a handmade, hand-lettered sign if you have enough money to buy my house outright?
She thought it might be a scam, a way to profit off of Austin homeowners who were having trouble paying rising property taxes.
I'm very aware and conscious of the crisis of affordability, the ways that I have seen just in the time that I've lived here, East Austin changed drastically and, you know, much more white, much more hip. And I'm very attuned to the ways that I see people trying to make money off of that.
Once Kolb saw the sign near her office, she couldn't stop noticing similar ones all around Austin. I set out to find some homemade real estate signs around town, and it wasn't long before I spotted one in North Austin at the intersection of 53rd and Duval Streets.
It's a big white cardboard sign. It's got writing in black marker that says, "Compro casas feas," or "I buy ugly houses." And there's a phone number listed here.
I called the number on the sign, and I got this message for a voicemail service.
"You have reached your friend's voicemail on Text Me. Please leave a message after the beep, and your friend will receive it within seconds. Speak now."
Hi, I'm calling about the sign on 53rd and Duval. Please give me a call. While I waited for a response, I called another number listed on a sign near Manor and Airport. It read, "Angel buys houses. Cash, money, dinero." Only to find that that number led me to the exact same voicemail.
Voicemail on Text Me.
Eventually, I got a call back from the man behind these signs, Angel Martinez. He says he's only been in the real estate business for about a month, and things have been fairly slow.
I've gotten pretty much people that are calling, and then they don't want to follow up, and yeah, it hasn't been too lucrative yet.
Martinez is part of a team that's buying up houses around Austin. Wholesalers like them buy up a bunch of properties and then quickly sell them off to investors. He and his partners advertise to people who are looking to sell their homes fast. If he decides the house would be a good investment, he'll offer to buy it in cash. Martinez says he typically closes these sales within 2 days. The trade-off is that wholesalers like him buy houses for less than the market rate. Martinez says he typically offers at least 70% of the home's market value. The owners agree to take a loss in exchange for a quick cash transaction.
Usually we mostly work with distressed sellers, people that are having trouble. Maybe they fell behind on their payments. that they're getting on a divorce or anything like that. And, you know, we offer them an easy and fast way out.
Then Martinez will turn around and wholesale it to a real estate investor. He says he typically makes a $5,000 or $10,000 profit on those transactions. Martinez has been putting signs all around the city. He doesn't focus on one particular neighborhood, though he says more and more wholesalers have their eyes on property in East Austin. I asked Martinez why the handwritten signs. He says aside from being cheap, he's heard they're more effective.
I've heard in a bunch of videos that more people get more feedback from the handwritten ones than the ones that are printed out. I guess makes people feel more like they will be talking to somebody more local.
But it turns out many of those signs are illegal.
They're actually known as bandit signs, or vertical litter is what a lot of people call them.
That's John Hale. He's an investigator with Austin's code department. Hale says it's against city code to post these signs in a right-of-way or on public property, which, of course, is where we typically see them.
I mean, it is a Class C misdemeanor, so it's punishable up to a $2,000 fine. We always like to give people the benefit of the doubt that they, you know, a new business they may not have known.
Hale says the code department does sign patrol on the weekends, picking up and throwing away these bandit signs. But it's not long before new ones pop up.
Wholesaling is kind of like this wild, wild west right now of real estate, especially in Texas.
Barrett Raven is a real estate agent and investor in Austin. He has a slight fascination with the wholesale market.
Most people don't even know what it is. I mean, ask a realtor right now, like, hey, what's wholesaling? What's wholesale investing? And like most people have no idea what it is. So it's kind of this like super niche, like subgroup of real estate investors even who are using this practice.
Raven says he's bound by a different code of ethics and he wouldn't try and buy someone's home for less than the fair market value. But when it comes down to it, wholesaling isn't illegal.
The thing that bothers me the most is just that there are people out there who are so desperate to sell that they can't wait to get fair market value on their home. I mean, honestly, like wholesaling, in my opinion, has a place in the marketplace.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting.
I reported my findings back to our question asker, Jennifer Kolb.
I feel a lot of sympathy for the people who feel that level of desperation that they need that kind of cash that fast. And so that's sounds kind of like a very challenging situation to be in.
Kolb was surprised to learn that advertising on these homemade signs was a marketing strategy to try and make the buyer seem more local.
I hadn't thought about that component of like the transaction seeming more possible and fast if it's like someone down the street from you that you can just run over and check in with. And I hadn't thought about that. But I don't think they're marketing it at me, so.
Now that Kolb's eyes are open to the strategy behind these signs, she won't look at them the same way again. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
For most of the last few decades, East Texas has been the venue for the largest percentage of patent infringement cases in the United States. But now, as KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court may take a lot of the air out of the East Texas patent litigation bubble.
Since the 90s, East Texas has been the venue to some of the biggest patent fights in the world because of three factors. The first was a 1990 appeals court decision that allowed the venue for a patent case to be wherever a company had done any business with the product in question, buying, selling, shipping, whatever, it could be sued there. The second factor, according to David Henry, was Judge T. John Ward, the then sitting judge in Marshall for the Eastern District of Texas.
My understanding, or at least so goes the lore, that he decided to have his law clerks and he decided himself to become versed in patent law to create some local patent rules, which ultimately became the foundation of many other federal districts across the country.
Henry is a patent lawyer for a Houston firm and teaches law at Baylor University. Those rules he's talking about sped up patent trials. Ward limited courtroom presentations with timers. He set limits on how long filings could be and strictly adhered to the calendar. The combination set up what came to be known as the Rocket Docket. Within 10 years, the number of patent cases in Marshall increased by more than tenfold.
I flew in and out of the Marshall Airport a number of times and four different patent cases. And you would see jets from countries all over the world there for patent cases. It was really a staggering phenomena.
Nearby federal judges in Tyler and Longview noticed the uptick and the economic benefit. They set up similar rules, bringing in even more cases. The third factor was the jury pool. Patent attorneys saw local juries as sympathetic to property rights. Put those together, and Henry estimates 40% of patent cases last year in the U.S. were filed in East Texas. But last week, the Supreme Court ruled lower courts should use an older, specific federal statute for patent suits when determining where a company resides. As a result, a company can only be sued where they are registered or it has a regular and established place of business. John Allison is a business professor at the University of Texas.
You know, unless they were formed in Texas, not very many corporations are incorporated in Texas. And actually, most Texas corporations are incorporated in Delaware. And so you're going to have, I suspect, a huge shift in patent infringement cases from the Eastern District of Texas to the District of Delaware.
The case that caused this seismic shift? T.C. Heartland versus Kraft Foods. A fight between two food conglomerates over flavored powder that can be added to water. It could end up leaving a bitter taste in East Texas for years to come. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
If you like Thai food, there's this food truck in Austin on East Cesar Chavez, started by a husband and wife team, and they've been serving Northern Thai street food for more than a year now. So here with his take on this place, DD Thai, is Austin American Statesman restaurant critic Matthew Odom. Hi, Matthew.
Hey there, Nathan.
I love Thai food.
You know, it's just that sweet and sour and salty and bitter and spicy and savory and toasty and floral and herbaceous. It finds harmony somehow.
So tell me about DD Thai, this food truck.
Justin Trubiana is an Austin native who was living in New York City, I think working in the financial markets. When the economy took a downturn, you know, almost a decade ago, he moved to Thailand to travel and volunteer. And there he met a woman, Lakana, who would become his wife, Lakana Trubiana. They lived there for a few years together. Her family is from northeastern Thailand, known as Isan. She's from Nong Khai. And so they lived up there. They moved back to the States. And they were living in Memphis, and then they decided to move to Austin because Justin thought this home cooking that his wife did, she'd never cooked professionally, was amazing, and he'd been spoiled for years by it, and he thought they could start a business. So she cooks everything from scratch in the trailer, and he kind of runs the front of the house, as it were.
And they have a small menu.
That's right. There's only a few items on there, and, you know, it's good for the kitchen space and for prep. It will take a few minutes because, again, most of it's cooked from scratch, of course. It's a small menu, but pretty much everything on it is great, such as the om gai, which is these tender chunks of chicken that swim in this herbaceous broth. It's fragrant with lemongrass and spring onion and fish sauce, of course, which you'll find in a lot of dishes, enlivened with Thai chili, and it also has dill, which you don't find a lot. And basil. So again, it's spicy, it's sour, it's herbaceous. They also have, speaking of spicy, you'll even get it sometimes when you don't expect it, unless, of course, you're real familiar with Thai food and you know that papaya salad, as tame as it might sound, can be really spicy. It's tossed with green beans and carrots and sweetened with a little bit of sugar and roasted peanuts and some bright cherry tomatoes. And another favorite of mine, sounds like they're all favorites, another favorite of mine, they only serve Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, their mu ping, which are these tangy, sweet, savory grilled pork skewers. And those are excellent. It's just like five for two of them. I feel like they could set up a mu ping food cart downtown and probably make a killing just off that.
So five for two of those, and what are the prices like generally?
You're looking at $9 or $10 a dish, and you can get filled up on one dish or take a crew and order the whole menu like I like to do.
Anything you didn't like about the place?
Not really. The only thing might be if you're eating spicy food in summer in Austin, it is a trailer, so it is outdoor seating. Some of it's shaded. It's in the same parking lot where La Barbecue has been now for a while, right there at East Cesar Chavez and Chacon.
Okay. The food truck is DD Thai, and you can read Matthew Odom's full review right now at Austin360.com or in Friday's print edition of the Austin American Statesman. Good to talk to you, Matthew. Thanks for this.
Always a pleasure, Nathan.
That that is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of June 2017. Thanks so much for listening. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and send any questions or comments you might have to nathan@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,